Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
This is Conspiranormal.
So, we are here, guys, with Jason Guzman and Aaron O'Brien, who are the team that brought the graphic novel Return to Snake Land, which I'll show briefly, but no one else is going to see that, because it's just, it's an audio podcast, but you'll probably see it on the graphic. Aaron was with us last year, back in, God, I think it was February. It was either February or March. I think it was March, actually.
It was just when COVID started, and we were literally talking about, like, maybe we need to start taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, shit.
Wow. I remember that conversation.
Yeah, I remember that. We actually had to go and, like, I think that night I actually had to leave here because there was a bit of a scare here. And
oh, really? That was the night?
That was the night, yeah. That you thought, yeah.
One of my roommates thought he had it.
Right.
And that was before we really knew anything, you know, about it, and it was way more scary. And
yeah. Just beginning. Yeah, really. Yeah.
I had to go back to my place, and that was the first, like, remote podcast that we did. And that was all the way to, like, September, and then we didn't really get back together in here until, like, March of this year, so... But here we are.
Yeah, I'm back, and it's just at the tail end, hopefully. So, but thanks for having me back and Jason.
Yeah.
As I stated before, I've been a huge fan of your show for a while. So, I really, really dig you guys. So,
yeah, well, we really appreciate you, and you had us on. You helped us out with a little bit of promotion for Strange Realities. You had us on the Synthaholics podcast not that long ago, and like there's also a Dune podcast. Surfiel's an expert on Dune.
Yep.
And I think Surfiel's read like all the books. Like he's one of the few. Yeah,
not all of his sons, but I've read
that gets weird. Yeah,
yeah. I've read like half of his sons.
But. Right.
Yeah. So Return to Snake Land. Let's talk about this, and Aaron had the chance last time to talk a lot about it. Jason, I want to kind of get your views, because Aaron is the artist and you are the writer, and I believe a lot of this comes from that kind of your own personal recollections at the time. So what is Snake Land and what is Return to Snake Land about? We'll just kind of review for anybody that hasn't heard that episode. You guys can go back, that's probably like episode 1033 or something, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
you guys can find that one. That's in the early 300s, I'm pretty sure, because it was kind of right after the 300th episode. But so Snake Land and Return to Snake Land.
Yeah. No, I mean, like for me, when I started writing all of this stuff, it was basically I had a blog that I was posting. on every so often. It was basically just the idea of, talking about the individual issues that cropped up in high school while I was there, the really more severe stuff. And then just trying to put it into like a format or some way that I could understand it, because just looking back, it just seemed very unreal to me. It just seemed like, all the murders and suicides and stuff. And as we found out later, sexual predators as well, was all going on. And it just seemed crazy to me that all that could be happening, but yet at the same time, we were living a very typical, suburban life as teenagers, playing in bands and trying to date various girls and whatever else, might be going on. But for me at the time then, Snakeland was basically just kind of a symbol for just everything that I was trying to figure out as an adult and put together, in some format. But Return to Snakeland very quickly turned into, something else. Once Aaron kind of announced himself, and was like, hey, I...
Here I am.
Yeah, more or less, polite enough, you've talked to Aaron, what he's like. But basically just that it took on a whole different idea in terms of not, just adding the art to it, and specifically Aaron's art, because it's very evocative and it mixes super well, I feel, with the text. And it really kind of just turned it into a whole separate thing, just really made the writing itself come to life. So as far as the work goes, I mean, I really consider it to be totally separate and much, much better than the stuff I was working on that I was posting on the blog. Sorry?
That's not true.
Okay, whatever, man.
I'm a fan of Jason's writing, so that's why I illustrated it. So,
yes. I mean, no, I mean, that's true. But I mean, we definitely have a real like mutual admiration society going on, so because as I said, I really think it turned it into something very different. But the odd thing about it was that after putting it out and doing the whole, Return to Snakeland graphic novel, it was still just this feeling that there was still more to say. That we had to dig deeper, most specifically in what you guys have probably already heard then in the first few episodes on the murder of Kathy Harold, and because that still remains unsolved. It's very much and it's also wrapped up pretty deeply in the Satanic Panic lore of that time period. So it's really the thread that the whole thing runs on. And because it is still unsolved, it really inspired us to really just keep rolling. And we found a lot more information, a lot more gaps that, we wanted to be filled, but still, for whatever reason, can't seem to find all the details of. But still fascinating though, man. I still love doing it. I really do.
And Jason, how old were you when this happened? Like, you were there in the high school when this was going on. So, like, roughly were the dates of all this?
Okay. Well, basically, like, just to give you the idea, pretty much I'm 14 when this begins, because I was born in December. So it just that, everything's almost kind of like a year pushed back. Like, for instance, we got my sophomore year, where you'd normally think a kid would be 15 for the duration there and stuff. And I was 14 for most of that. But the sophomore year, 1985 through 1986, is when the lion's share of this stuff happens. And it begins really with that murder of Kathy Harold at Snakeland proper, which, you know, Aaron, you know, is the best source for actual material on Snakeland, you know, as far as the actual buildings and stuff went. But she was murdered. There was definitely satanic overtones, and that was July 1st of 1985. So it was smack dab in the middle of summer vacation for us. And we came back in September. She used to sit right in front of me in the, you know, the homeroom that we had there. And that year we came back and she didn't. And there wasn't really any discussion of it. We just found out about it from other kids, basically, and all the, you know, the rumors and everything else attached to it. They just had us move up one desk in a homeroom, and that was essentially, you know, all the notice that was paid. It was pretty sad, honestly, and pretty crummy when you consider it, you know, just some, you know, 15-year-old girl, you know, murdered at that time. So, but soon after we got back to school, that's when John Justice killed his whole family and then drove through a stoplight and ended up killing somebody else, totally innocent driver. But that was almost like this 1-2 punch. And although it was pretty shocking and stuff at the time, what's most interesting to me about it was that how much, again, we just seemed to, I don't want to say brush it off, but just really didn't, we certainly weren't feeling threatened or afraid or filled with anxiety or anything like that. But that's in and of itself, that's pretty odd. You know, I mean, when you consider all that was happening, and there was more, of course, but get into that.
Yeah, you guys do a really good job in the graphic novel of kind of setting the time and the place and how these murders and all this type of stuff that was going on really affected you and affected the other people around you. And Aaron, you kind of came a little bit after this, like I guess you had heard of some of this,
right?
But you were familiar with Snakeland as well.
I had moved into the area and I wanted to check out the creepiest place in my neighborhood. So that's where I was led to. And, you know, I heard the rumors, I heard the stories about Kathy Harold and John Justice and all this stuff. So, it was, you know, interesting as a young kid and, you know, kind of scary too. But yeah, I went and explored that area for Snakeland and the grain elevators and stuff like that. So I got to actually, you know, take in all that visual information and what I could put into the graphic novel. So, and I have a reference on, you know, the size, the place and the area. So, and just so people know too, I mean, the actual grain elevators were demolished back in, I think, 2000 or 2001. Mm-hmm. So, and you can look it up on YouTube, it's called Snakeland Destroyed. So yeah. there's a good video for that. So,
mm-hmm. Well, so for anyone who hasn't listened to the episode with you on it, do you want to give them a primer on what Snakeland is?
Yeah. Well, Snakeland, was a place, an abandoned grain elevator, two buildings side by side and by some railroad tracks. And there were some fields and some like a wooded area nearby too, and the kids would go there to party. And it wasn't a nice place, but it was just a place to get away from everything. And of course, this is during the 80s, and you have a lot of metalheads going back there, so they're into Black Sabbath, they're into, you know, all sorts of stuff like Slayer and, you know, whatever other bands are out at the time. And they're doing pentagrams, you know, upside down crosses, and who knows, I mean, there's a lot of talk of like satanic practices going back there. Me and Jason are somewhat skeptical. It's not that we don't think there was anything, but I think it was a lot of kids just having fun, drinking and just being silly. But, you know, maybe there were a couple people who were taking that a little more serious than others. And of course, with Kathy Harold and her unsolved murder was linked to this. And she was killed just outside Snake Land. And a lot of people thought, well, it obviously was a Satanist that killed her. Well, you know, we have some differing ideas on this. But and that's what our podcast that we're putting out is trying to explore.
So is that still kind of the rumor there in that area, is that she was killed by a Satanist?
Well, it's that's one of them. The other one, as we get into, I think the third episode of our podcast is the bike path rapist or killer, and Antimio Sanchez, who was caught in 2007, and some of his murder style is similar to how Kathy was killed, but we think a little differently about it. So, and we explore, unfortunately, in depth of what Sanchez did, and it's probably our least favorite discussion about that whole thing because it's just so awful.
So when did this this kind of like industrial park, I guess, when did it go out of operation?
1965, or
I believe you are correct. Yeah, it was 65. The place closed, you know, for business, never reopened again for, you know, like any kind of productive business type stuff. And eventually, unfortunately, the deaths started happening before Kathy Harold, midway through the 1970s. I believe it was about midway through. What year was it, Aaron, that Dan McCracken died?
I think it was 70. I'd have to look it up again, but I think it's like 72 or 73 or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. But definitely earlier on. And he was just a 12-year-old kid who was playing in there with his friends and made the wrong choice, you know. And as you know, I'm sure Aaron told you, as he would tell you, it was incredibly dangerous, and, you know, for adults and or kids, you know, it was just ridiculous. But he died from a fall, and then you kind of figured that something more would have happened at that point after, you know, one kid dies, and that they'd do something real to make sure, but didn't work out that way. And then we had Joe F. We're calling him he was really the first suicide, the first of the Ken West suicides that we were tracing. And he it was 1981, and he committed suicide by jumping off a platform or something along those lines. And so it is one of those situations, like if this were like a Stephen King book, this would be why you know, other murders happened or anything else happened in Snake Land, because, you know, once Snake Land had a taste for blood, you know, like this would, you know, be like it's reasoning for to continue to kill, you know. But the fact is just that, sadly enough, I mean, it sounds like it was just, you know, another, you know, teenage suicide, you know.
And what gets me about it is, you know, and we talk about this, you know, through the podcast, is so you have this abandoned area that's, you know, obviously now two kids have died, and now it's attracting kids to party and stuff like that, you know, and it gets to a point where, like, what does it take for public officials, police to, and all the, you know, anybody, your trusted guardians of your community to actually do something? Like, this is, and we make a joke, but absentee landlord basically didn't take care of his property. Some business moved away, went bankrupt or whatever, and it just sat there a derelict for forever. And it's like, you know, I can enjoy that as an urban explorer, but when you're talking about, like, people actually, like, bad things happening to people, like, what does it take, man? It's like, and it literally took, you know, 25 years for them to finally, like, demolish this thing. I mean, it's preposterous, you know? And so I it makes you wonder, like, what the heck is wrong with the people who are supposed to be running the show? you know.
Right.
It just infuriates me more and more as I get older. You know, when I was younger, it's like more cool because it's right. like, you know, it's interesting. Yeah. It's danger, right? Yeah. But now I'm just like, I mean, I have kids now. I'm like, what the hell is going on with you people? Yeah. So
it's pretty shocking, you know. And one, you guys probably know this phrase. I don't know who to attribute it to, but nature hates a purposeless thing. And basically that's what Snakeland was. I mean, it was basically just this empty, you know, I don't even know really like what a good word for it would be other than just, you know, what it was, but it was vast and it had no purpose. And the purpose then eventually became, beyond, you know, just, you know, a place for people to die. It was a place to party, you know, the way that a lot of abandoned places become a place to party, you know. Well, but
and it had been like a few generations by that time,
right,
as we understand it. Yeah, I mean, the earliest we have information about that part of it would be when that Joe F. person committed suicide, but pretty much from 81 straight on, and you got to figure this was happening in the 70s too, but we just don't have any records. But just constant, like, you know, just this was the place to go and party, and it had multiple parts of it, you know, that people would go to, and they all had names, like, what was it, Aaron, you know this, I think, the Stairway to Heaven and the Stairway to Hell, something
sure, along yeah, those that, lines. Yeah.
And then there was obviously the Rungless Ladder and the Midget Room and, you know, whatever was going down in the basement. I mean, it's crazy to think about, but that's pretty much where it ended up being, was just the place where everyone went to the party.
Had this been like the economic engine of the community previous to it being shut down?
Yeah. So before, I mean, and if you came to, I mean, you know, you guys probably have things similar to it, but we have a ton of grain elevators, grain silos in the right. Buffalo, Western New York area. Sure. We had the Erie Canal, obviously, that came through and came from Albany to Buffalo, and then it would, Erie Canal connected to Lake Erie where they could ship out, you know, to Chicago or wherever, you know, Detroit. So we were like sort of a hub for a while for transportation, for grains, for cement and for other aggregates and stuff like that. So, you know, like all the railroad tracks were going through here and the, you know, shipping, and that lasted for a long time. And then, there's another canal that was put up into Canada that kind of like made the Erie Canal sort of like moot. There was no point of it anymore. And it kind of was abandoned. We still had the train tracks and stuff like that. And, you know, that was like early, you know, 1900s going into, you know, the 1950s was the big boom. And then things slowly petered out over time. So you have now an economic decay. And so the Snakeland, the buildings, the grain silos were abandoned like 1965-ish in that time. Mm-hmm. And it just left to rot. And so, you know, just literally crumbling giant behemoths of buildings.
Yeah, I'm interested in that relationship, that this was probably like a place of that mid-century promise.
Yeah.
And then you get the slow economic decay by the 80s, probably deindustrialization's in full swing. And it becomes like its liminality is in the symbolism of the different economic ages, too. And it's like this symbol of this industrial age that's gone. And some of that nihilism really gets reflected in the children, because they don't have that promise anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Excellent point.
That's a pretty good point right there. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
They're just hanging out and crawling all over this industrial wasteland.
Well, sure, yeah. No, but I mean, Sir Fail, that's an excellent point, and that's exactly kind of what was happening. So you had all these opportunities, and you know, I don't know how Jason felt, but at a time you were like, you grew up, and this was actually kind of the genesis of John Justice, that he was expected to get a job at a factory and just be, you know, a drone. And John Justice was, you know, very intelligent, and he wanted to go to college and stuff like that. And his parents couldn't even see that. There was not that was not part of their plan for him. And he was like, I want to do more. So he went crazy. He wasn't right in the head. You know, he was highly intelligent, but not right in the head. So he ended up murdering his family.
Sure.
But that being said, yeah, that has a lot to do with, you know, growing up, your parents had all these opportunities and all of a sudden, like, where are these opportunities? Like, why am I, you know, not getting a good job? Why am I not seeing the opportunities I had before?
And everything just appeared in the media.
Yeah. So, the 70s and 80s, it really just went down. Mm-hmm. And that is the rot. You know, you're seeing the rot of an industrial, you know, engine at one point, and it just left. And that's the other thing. It's just like, that's just left, and people are just like, whatever, you deal with it.
Yeah. It's what's funny about it is that, you know, I mean, Surfield's point, I think, is really borne out, unfortunately, by, like, my family at the time, which was my dad was working for the General Motors powertrain, and he had been laid off for about 2 years in the very early 80s, and then started coming back on by the time 1984 rolled around, you know, that basically he went back to work. And it's actually kind of unfortunate, because in the meantime, he had gone to community college to learn to do, to be honest with you, I wasn't paying any attention at that time. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what he was learning how to do, but the fact is that as soon as he got done, then, you know, GM, you know, was doing well enough that they called him back to work. And what was he going to do? I mean, like, that in that area, in that time period, like 1984, 85, you know, what we've been talking about, you weren't going to do better in our town. So the fact is that he went back, you know, and I think that's also, it's directly reflected in John Justice and his parents, you know, who did factory work as well, and that, you know, basically we're just kind of looking at it like, you know, this was what we had to do, so it's what you're going to do. You know, there's very much that sense of you had two choices. You know, I mean, you could go to the factory and do this, or you could, you know, I mean, there wasn't even, the second choice wasn't even really delineated for you. It was just that, you know, it was grim. You know, there just weren't options as far as people saw them. Now, you know, again, other folks, you know, would just come in and say, like, I'm just going to go, you know, join a band and, like, tour around and stuff. Or I'm going to go to the big city and just, you know, learn how to do something, you know, whatever it might be, you know. I mean, that, you know, taking chances, but there was definitely a sense in that time, especially, of a real nihilism, as you had said. And that just, there were just no options, no real choices to be made. So, or at least that's the way it was made to appear.
Well, you've got some things going on in that time period as far as, you know, everything with, like, Reaganomics and the kind of the whole neoliberal thing, closing down the factories, the more the emphasis on the service industry, or the more the emphasis on, like, hedge funds and all the stuff that was going on in Wall Street. And then you also, so you have this kind of crumbling industrial infrastructure like we've been talking about, but then you've also got the rise of the moral majority. And it seems like you've got, you know, this contributes a lot to the satanic panic.
Aspect
of all of this, because you've got this increasing nihilism, but then that feeds into the satanic panic and what's going on there. So, you know, can't help but notice, of course, there is, you know, a Baphomet and imagery on there. So you guys do kind of, within this graphic novel, you guys do play with that whole satanic panic imagery. And so was there an inkling of that with, you know, John Justice killing his family, Kathy Harold's murder, all these type of things that were going on, where there were, and also just the fact that I'm sure that there were some, I don't know, Slayer was spray painted on a wall in Snake Land once or twice, you know,
right.
So
more than,
know,
that,
how did this contribute to just, like, that general feeling of, I guess, the hysteria? It's like a microcosm of the macrocosm of the hysteria of the times.
Mm. Well, in one way you can look at it, it was just like, it was just that idea of, like, Satanism on a, like, just on a, on a,
you know, like day-to-day, like student kind of level, you know, not exactly encompassing the real satanic panic, but just in general, is that, again, you know, without any options. And if you were, you know, I don't want to generalize about the head, but if you were a head,
he means metalheads.
Oh yeah, exactly. Heshers, headbangers, whatever they call them in your town, you know, the drill there. A lot of those guys and girls didn't have a whole heck of a lot of options either. And with Satanism, you had danger, you had glamour, you know, to an extent. You had,
it's pure rebellion. Pure rebellion.
Oh no, and absolutely, and that too. Just by being present, you were rebelling against your parents. You know, right. And that's, you know, I mean, in and of itself, is not necessarily a bad thing. It just led to bad things.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I see this like strange loop being created, because probably what was just a bunch of kids in a lot of places in America partying and spray painting satanic heavy metal graffiti would lead satanic investigators to use this as proof of some grand satanic conspiracy, which then, you know, gets broadcast through their media back to these metalheads or kids who may not have heard of this or that band until this preacher on this VHS tape talks about Slayer and shows the album cover.
It's a feedback loop.
Yeah. So it's this weird, strange loop going on.
Right. And that's exactly. So it's like, you know, it is pure rebellion. And while I love the idea of, you know, spray painting, you know, upside down crosses and Slayer and Ozzy on things, I think that's wonderful.
I'd pick different bands myself, but
I'm just saying I love the idea behind it and stuff like that, but it was probably purely horrifying to a parent who probably grew up in the 1960s 1950s, and they're just like, what is wrong with my children? Like, what is going on? And then, you know, you're seeing, or even if your kid, you have kids that aren't doing that, but then you're seeing other kids, you're like, oh my God, we have to protect them from this, you know? So that it just gets worse. And then the kids see it and they're like, oh, what's that about? And so they got to check that out. So, I mean, it's just, like I said, it's a feedback loop. It just keeps on getting worse. And, you know, I mean, and me and Jason have talked, I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are really into the Satanism side of it, but it seems like most of them are just there to have a good time, you know, just to go back there and party with their friends, you know, smoke some weed, drink and stuff like that, you know, but I mean, somebody took things too far, you know, so. Yeah.
Just as simple as that. And it's the same thing with, you know, we were speaking a little bit before we got started about the Sons of Sam documentary that had come out, and you got a similar situation, just a some sort of, you know, abandoned way station full of satanic iconography and stuff, and you know, like murdered, you know, German shepherds and all these kinds of things. But right. But unfortunately, you know, it just, again, no matter how you slice it, whether you believe their theory or not, you know, just in terms of, you know, about that David Berkowitz was absolutely helped along, you know, the fact that he was even there is, you know, just kind of shows it to be that this was more than just, once again, mm-hmm. like a place to party. It was something actually, you know, damaging, you know, actually dangerous, not just in the, you know, the grand scheme of, like, you know, Satan figure.
To continue on this for a little bit before we get to Kathy and some of the details of that murder, I do kind of just want to point out how the idea of youth being a separate thing itself is kind of like a 20th century creation of the Western world. And then this idea of that being, you know, a teenager is really like a specifically American mid-century thing, where teenagers, you know, get their own world, and that's often, you know, tied up in different subcultures. And because they are trying to create their own world, they seek out and have seems to always seek out these liminal spaces. I don't know if the kids do it now because of technology, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I mean, I know when I was growing up, I mean, that's what we did. And I grew up with a lot of metalheads too, and punk rockers and stuff. And no matter what subculture the kids were into, they seek out these liminal spaces to like create their own worlds and their own orders.
And to go along with that, I mean, I think that's exactly what happens. You know, they're just escaping mm-hmm. from their parents or, you know, mm-hmm. Their teachers and whoever else. So they're trying to find a space to escape to. Nowadays, I think you're right. I don't think as many kids are exploring those things. I think they're going into cyberspace and they're going on to their, you know, games, and they can talk. Mm-hmm. Talk on their games, and they can create their own worlds and their own, like, you know, things going on. So it's a different thing. And sure, it's maybe more safe physically, maybe not mentally, but I don't, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, we're all just, you know, learning to find some sort of escapism at that time, because, you know, I mean, you're a teenager, you see the burden of adulthood coming at you. It is going to crush you at some point, right? So you know that you better get the most out of this time as much as possible. So, and sure. I think the people that's in Snakeland, I mean, the ones that were just there to have a good time, probably got the most out of their teen years compared to mm-hmm. most.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think again, you know, for the most part, you know, overall, you can absolutely say that about those kids. And I used to think, and this doesn't directly, you know, this is more like, you know, the whole idea of teenagers in general, or just teenagers in America, you know, like the whole thing. And like, you know, how we used to break ourselves up into these little tribes of like punk rockers or heads, or, you know, the drama kids or the docs, you know, and like these kinds of things. But like, it was this process of discovering ourselves in a way. But also, I used to think, honestly, that the period of, like, being a teenager, even though it was annoying to everybody else around, was actually kind of like a sacred time in
yeah.
your life, you know, where you made some determinations about, you know, who you were going to be and you know, and really what you wanted and what you didn't want and that sort of thing. And if you were like us, you were planning your escape, you know, so that you didn't have to go to the factory, you know, that kind of thing. And I used to think of it as like a very sacred time in our lives. I don't really feel that way anymore, you know, kind of the way that I look back on that stuff now. And obviously, you know, got a lot of it out in the actual writing of Return to Snakeland, you know, like the graphic novel. But just that it seems like it's not so much like that's a common thing, that idea of like a, you know, a sacred process of like, you know, defining yourself. It's not like some kids do decide to do that, and some kids do use that time period for that, and other kids don't, you know. So it's taken on a different mm-hmm. way for me. And when my grandkids actually become teenagers, I'm sure I'm going to feel entirely different by then anyway, but you know, it's a whole different thing, I think, really.
Yeah.
You know, worth talking about though.
It's initiatory. We do have formal rituals, like I guess high school graduation, prom, things like that. But for, you know, they lack some of the danger, especially that young men are looking for. There's a guy, Peter Lamborn Wilson, who's like a radical Sufi. He hates the idea of drug legalization and even marijuana legalization, because he's like, this is really the only thing that's almost universal for kids to go through some kind of initiatory process where they're like, there's danger involved, there's secrecy, there's like, you know, so there's people are seeking to do the same coming of age things that they've always done, and they'll just use whatever culture and things are around them to do that, especially with things like heavy metal. I mean, and youth subcultures of the time, they're like, they're little mini warrior cults, you know, like.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. And I don't think you see that, at least not around music. anymore. I mean, kids are going to find ways to, you know, like treat each other like shit no matter what. But that just with the music cults, you know, the way we were broken up was just like very much like, you know, that's, you know, you identified with your little tribe. And as far as it went, and this is apparent through the, you know, the book and the podcast, the my tribe was very small and the Heads tribe was very big. And that's why a lot of it too was like just coming at it from being like a total outsider to that, like, you know, just that tribal way of life, that it really was just much more so about Kathy's murder and about, you know, again, the ideas or the interesting stuff that was attached to it, you know, because of, and, you know, our friend Diane's dream and, you know, all that stuff. So.
The murder of Kathy Harrell. Let's talk about the details of this. You know, I mean, she was killed in a pretty brutal fashion. There's, I guess, a few suspects, but and also kind of like what you guys maybe speculate might have happened. And I definitely want to talk about that poem, because you guys are doing a good job in presenting some supernatural aspects that I haven't really heard in a lot of true crime podcasts. There's some interesting things. Jason, just as an aside, these that you depict in the graphic novel, did you actually have some of these dreams?
Those dreams actually, those were pretty much totally fabricated for the graphic novel. That wasn't. I did have individual dreams about Kathy, not many, but there was a couple. But for the most part, like as far as the justices went or the series of suicide, I don't remember anything. That it was mostly that part of it was really just for a framing effect, you know.
Right. And so the Kathy, she was we get into a lot of detail in the podcast about her. So she unfortunately her father passed away a year before while they were in Mexico of a heart attack, and she took it hard. It was a difficult time for her, and she was 14 to 15 years old. And she started rebelling, you know, as a, you know, consequence and of that death. And, you know, I think that's just like we were saying before, it's just part of initiation of youth, right? Mm-hmm. She starts hanging out with the metalheads, and she starts going back to the Snake Land area where everyone parties. It seems from all accounts that Kathy is very socially active. She's got a lot of friends. She has boyfriends. So there's a lot going on there, right? So she's sped up her life, you know, probably from, you know, a quiet, you know, life to, you know, like 100 miles per hour kind of thing. And unfortunately, one night, she had a lot of strife at home with her mom and her sister, and her sister was trying to help her out. And we go into a lot of details how her sister was helping her at the time. And, you know, she seems like things are going better for her. She's in therapy, and her mom says, "Oh yeah, go out to the park with your friends." Well, she never goes, or if she does go to the park, we don't know, but she goes to, she leaves at some point at night, and she never comes back home. And the police, or not the police, don't find her. Some train yard workers find her on the tracks, and she had been strangled. And I believe she hit in the head too, right, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conflicting reporting initially, because it's all done by the smaller papers, like the town papers in the area. It's not done by the city of Buffalo paper, but as far as we can tell at the time, she was beaten about the face and head, and that's, we don't know what caused it, but there was a gash above, I think it was her right eye. And then of course was she single legged or double?
Single legged, sure. Yeah. Okay. She had been strangled with a garrote. Yeah. Garrote.
Yeah.
So,
is initially what led them to think that it might have been Altimio Sanchez, but beyond that one aspect, they're just the rest of it was just totally circumstantial. So,
Right. And so obviously she's in Snake Land. Snake Land's got pentagrams. It's got upside down crosses, 666 written everywhere. Everyone automatically thinks Satanists did this. And it kind of sets off the town from there, you know, from the, you know, the police reacting, and it's and you, it, we go through all these articles written by all the different newspapers at the time. And what's crazy to me is that they don't even focus on Kathy. I mean, that's a side right. note that she had died, and they focus on the Satanism aspect. And you're just like, what are you? I mean, like, it's bizarre, you know, like if they handled the death on one side and then they did another article on Satanism, but they just kind of like just push that all aside and then they just go right to the Satanism aspect. And
that's what sold papers. I mean, yeah.
Right. It's exactly. True. It's sensationalism. Absolutely. So, and so it, that's what takes this whole thing to a point where people gets interested in it, but then the police never find anything, or they don't, or if they do, it's never publicly known. And as Jason alluded to just a couple of minutes ago, Antimio Sanchez, when he was caught for all the past rapes and killings he had done, he's labeled in the Buffalo area as the bike path rapist, bike path killer. That it looked like it could have been him. And a lot of things really do look like it could be him. But there's a lot of stuff like, why wouldn't they put that on? Like, he's been caught. He's in prison. He's never getting out. Why wouldn't they have put Kathy's conviction onto him at that point if it was like, this is obviously him? They couldn't prove it. He denied it. So,
right. And this would have been, well, this would have been his first murder. You know, right. Essentially he was just a serial rapist up until a point. But if he had killed Kathy would have been the first, as I said, you know, it's like his first murder. And in our way of thinking, you know, and we've discussed this at some length, and not because we wanted to, but because we just had to figure this all out. It just seemed that if, you know, what we know about murder, or what we know about an individual taking that step, going beyond, you know, I'm not saying just rape, but he was a rapist. We get it, you know. But the thing was, is that to go over here to actually murdering women was, you know, another step. And it just doesn't seem like the manner in which Kathy was murdered would have been that kind of a murder. It wasn't disordered. It wasn't like in disarray. It was pretty much a pretty well laid out, you know, tableau, unfortunately. But that would indicate to me, or I think to anybody else, that with that murder specifically, we're looking at an organized and perhaps planned murder. You know, as opposed to what something that, you know, Sanchez would have just found himself into and then flipped out and killed her.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, Visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
So he worked not too far away from there, so that I think that was the main circumstantial evidence that they think that maybe he did it. But also, I mean, from that description, it kind of sounds like makes me think about that. You know, could it have been a possibility that it was someone she knew, and that she was kind of lured into a sense of complacency by this person?
Sure. I mean, I think without going too far down that road, I mean, I think both Aaron and I believe that that may well be the case, and one of the reasons, again, may not be the most rational, but has to do with, you know, what we're reading from the poem from Kathy, and that, you know, again, most regular folks or folks who are not interested or don't put any real stock in the paranormal, you know, probably wouldn't take it very seriously. But I should say that both of us have found differing elements in that dream specifically, but just in the other stuff just surrounding.
Maybe you should explain the dream.
Yeah, like how that comes about, like what, who has this dream
after Kathy's death?
Yeah, what is said?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Basically, the individual who had the dream about Kathy after Kathy's murder was a lady by the name of Diane Tesmer, and she was Kathy's. She was her tutor. I don't know specifically what subject it was, but she was tutoring her. And so this would be an individual that wasn't really close with emotionally, but at the very least, you know, that they knew each other. Okay. And then the one night, Diane had a dream about Kathy, where Kathy was wandering around it wasn't Snake Land specifically, because Diane, you know, didn't have any experience with Snake Land, she said, and, you know, couldn't have imagined it, but she said it was industrial. And as she wanders around, actually, I don't have the book within easy reach. Give me one second. I'll grab it and we can go through the... You don't have it, do you, Aaron?
Adam has it right there.
You want to read the poem?
Yeah, let me find it. I think it's a little bit towards the guys.
Almost the end.
Yeah, it's broken up over a few panels, but yeah.
Okay, so
you better read it spooky.
Yeah.
put a little reverb on that.
So or try I'll to sound like a teenage girl. Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, don't do that.
I might try. You know. So I'll just read it from here. Soon after Hannah had been murdered, Donna had a dream about her. Hannah was in her typical head uniform, denim vest, black concert t-shirt, tight stonewashed jeans, strappy black boots, but her eyes were silvery scratches. Like when someone would escape something out on a Polaroid, or scrape something out on a Polaroid or a piece of movie film. She walked along a concrete wall in a place that wasn't Snake Land, but was kind of industrial like Snake Land. She started talking to Donna, and this is what she said. So, the cats create, anticipate. There's six of them and one of me. But they'll all die. Then I am free. Cats and rats have heart attacks. And they all die, and we all die, and they all live, and we all live. But snakes don't die. They multiply and shed their skins and say goodbye.
So that's the poem and a little bit of
sure,
the setup there.
Sure thing.
And that is verbatim, right, Jason? Like that is exactly what Diane.
No, it's not. No. In fact, I got to admit it. I did it from memory, and then I totally just like rewrote it. And I wasn't thinking at the time, Adam. I was trying to pull a fast one on you there. But the whole ending with the snakes, that didn't exist in the original poem. The main thing that the poem gave us was in the first part of that, I'd say that The cats create, anticipate. There's, I say six, but it's actually three. There's three of them and one of me. And what that began us thinking during this part of it was making a connection to several times over the course of the various articles about Kathy's murder where they talk about giving a lie detector test to three individuals, or taking three individuals in for questioning, that sort of thing. Excuse me. So that number keeps coming back up. And then later on in it, with the larger number, I think it was 8 to 10, kept coming up in the articles, where one of the police officers kept talking about
the eight individuals that were
absolutely
active, that were like the ringleaders in Snakeland.
Right, the hardcore Satanists. You know, the guys that actually believed hardcore. In this stuff. So at the time that we first heard this, we didn't have any knowledge of the articles or anything along those lines. Pretty much it was all just about the rats and the cats. And, you know, like, basically, like, who did what, like, you know, like, the cats were the ones maybe who planned the murder, and, you know, the rats were the ones that actually, you know, did it, and that sort of thing. But since Aaron and I started plugging away at this thing, it's really been just the numbers that have kept popping up that have made us think that there's something to that. Some were actually further along than others. You know, as far as like the three individuals, we think we might actually have something there. But the eight, you know, number of like hardcore Satanists, not as much. But it's one way or the other. It's fascinating just to think that there was even the possibility, because Diane was not a person who was prone to exaggeration, was prone to, you know, any kind of supernatural thinking, just like math and science type person. So when she did, you know, write down the poem when she woke up and then gave it to her boyfriend, Jason, who then gave it to all of us, you know, basically her friends, his friends. There was a lot to take into account at that point, and we just, you know, we just didn't have it at that back.
And she had been Kathy's teacher,
a tutor.
Okay, so she had been a tutor. Had Kathy been known to write poetry when she was alive?
So. What we do know is that Kathy was taking guitar lessons from he's not nationally known, but in the area, he was kind of like the big rock star. His name, Mark Freeland. And he was like this like weird conglomeration.
Apparently he hung out with Johnny Thunders, which was
cool. Yeah, right. Exactly. Weird conglomeration of like a Mick Jagger, Bowie, punkish, but just really weird, just an odd guy, right?
Very, very odd.
I've seen him in concert quite a few times over the years, and he's entertaining. I don't know if I would go out and buy all his records, but mm-hmm. So he was kind of like a big deal at the time, you know, and he was doing a lot of shows, and he was giving her lessons, so she was definitely artistic. I'm just not sure like if she did anything serious other than that. So
right, if she was actually writing songs or poems, then, you know, that would fit into it. But
I would think any girl who could pick up a guitar probably was writing a song. I mean, I would.
I think, yeah, pretty much anybody who could pick up a guitar usually would be writing.
And you said that some of the members of Green Jello knew her.
Yeah. They were friends with her sister. And her sister kind of, I think, kind of brought them along, brought Mark Freeland along to kind of help Kathy through what was, you know, an incredibly difficult period. You know, it's funny because we kind of forget the fact that Kathy's sister was also going through a pretty terrible time as well, right, as her mother. You know, it's just that it's pretty apocalyptic when, you know, dad just has a heart attack in another country, you know, and pretty tough to get over, you know. And but again, her sister was really trying. And as I said, she knew local freaks, local musicians, you know, whatever, and wanted to influence her in a good way, you know. And I think honestly, it's really noble of her in that sense to try to do that. It's just that
that's a good big sister.
Yeah. I mean, totally. But it didn't.
Green Jello is a definite blast from my high school years. That's who can forget the claymation videos, you know?
And they were just a band that was in the Kenmore Buffalo area, and you just kind of like took it as like, okay, these guys. And then when they hit the national, you're just like, what?
I remember they had to change their name because Jello was copyrighted, so they had to change it to Green Jelly.
Green Jelly, right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
When I saw the Ramones, they opened for them, and they were not like the claymation band at that point. They were just really incredibly bizarre, and a lot of creative costume making and that kind of thing. So I mean, I guess that kind of showed for the future. But you know, the music was pretty. You know, when your bassist only has one string, you kind of know that the music is not really your primary focus.
I'm gonna be honest. But getting back to, yeah, so Kathy, she had some like good people around her trying to help her, mm-hmm, through this. Unfortunately, I think she had a other foot in an area where people probably didn't have her best interest, or trying to take advantage of her and do whatever they wanted. You know, and what spurred on her killing is a different story. It's, you know, I think it has a lot to do with their mindset, you know, other than hers. Like, I think she was just looking to be with friends, you know, and she unfortunately just, I think, as Jason said in the podcast, she just had an incredible string of bad luck.
Well, you guys are looking at the poem as a possible clue to who murdered her. That's kind of where I'm... So I was curious if you guys have ever... That actually jogged my memory about... this is actually a very famous paranormal case, the Teresita Bossett case. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't believe so.
This was a case where a ghost actually was instrumental in catching her own murderer. So Teresita Bossa was a Filipino nurse that lived in Chicago. This was, I think, late 70s, maybe early 80s. I remember the first time I ever saw this was an Unsolved Mystery, so take it back to the 80s there for a second. But, I mean, this is well documented. She actually appeared... She was murdered mysteriously. It looked like her apartment had been set on fire. Then her ghost started to appear to this other Filipino nurse that barely knew her. And she said, "I'm Teresita Bossa. This person killed me." And to kind of make a long story short, you know, they got this lady went to the police. They confronted this guy and said that, you know, they kind of turned the screws on him and he confessed to doing it.
It sounds actually now vaguely familiar. I think I have heard the story, but it's back in some old brain cells that are.
Yeah, it's a very compelling. It's actually a very, very compelling paranormal case, and
that I, you know, when Jason, so like when we talk about it in the podcast, you know, we kind of gave the, you know, caveat. It's like, hey, like maybe this means nothing to you. This is just a weird dream, but to me, I feel like it has something. At least it'd be wonderful to think that maybe Kathy reached out to Diane, you know, at some point and just try to give her some message, you know, who knows, but it was powerful enough that Diane felt that she had to write this poem down, from her dream. I mean, I don't know any of us, most of us might write something down when you wake up or think about something, but usually you don't like dwell on it. You're just like, you roll over and like, man, that was a weird dream, you right. know? But she felt this is like important, like a message that she had to write down. And then, you know, she shares with her boyfriend, she shares it, the boyfriend shares it with Jason and others. So, you know, I think it's got to mean something. And then when we look into the articles and we see, yes, you know, they're questioning three people. There looks like there's eight ringleaders of this satanic thing. So, like, does it mean something? I don't know. But Diane didn't know any of that stuff probably beforehand, you know. So these we're combining all these articles together. But at the time, you know, like you probably don't read every article that comes out on the paper. So, you know, we're giving it everything condensed, you know, and it's not stretched out between months. So, and, it seems more powerful when you look back in retrospect.
Well, it may just serve as like an oracle that leads you to places of things that are more concrete, no matter how concrete the actual poem is or the origin of it, etc. You know, the use of the other in research, the method may seem very unscientific, very weird, non-material to people, but those methods can lead you to actual concrete things.
I don't doubt that. And I think you can start finding, it might spur a thought or even like a direction while you're looking at stuff. So, we have that information, and I think it was worth sharing during the podcast and in the book, the graphic novel. But I mean, maybe that can give us some more direction as time progresses, because this is still something we're still, you know, bringing together information. So
right. And I mean, that's the thing too, is that, I mean, both of us, obviously, because we're doing this, I mean, we would like to help bring Kathy's murderer to justice, of course. I mean, I think anybody doing this type of work would want that. But at the same time, you know, I don't know what the chances of that are. You know, I don't know, again, if this is a 3-5-year-old murder, you know, I don't know what the case is, but I do know that I think we've done the best possible job of putting together the available information, and that continues through the rest of the podcast. But it's you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, of course, I think we're giving people the best possible shot as far as saying, oh, I was there, oh, three guys, oh, you know, whatever it might be, that jogs something that, you know, kind of brings this to a close. But I'm also not arrogant enough, and I know Aaron isn't, you know, to think that, you know, oh, we're going to do it. Where everyone else failed, we're going to do it, you know. I mean, we're going to try to put everything out there that we can to make things right. But
yeah, and we'll do it. And as I've expressed before on the podcast, is that I would love that this to be solved. You know, I think that's important. But the other thing is, this isn't a historical document. Mm-hmm. I look at it's a podcast and the graphic novel. I mean, we change the names in the graphic, or Jason does at the time. So we're, but I look at it as a historical document, because I just find it bizarre that people don't know these things. And, you know, this is, you know, right in your own neighborhood. And as I get older, I find it odd that I don't consider myself, you know, brilliant by any chance of the imagination, but that I know things about history that most people don't about their own community. And I'm just like, how do you not know this? Like, you know, okay, this is like a dark side of it, but that's the problem, is people just turn away from the dark side. You guys had some great guests, you know, talking about the whole QAnon aspect, some podcasts back. And, you know, that has direct relations to the satanic panic. It's like everything's just you know, recycled and rehashed and stuff like that. If you don't know your past, you're just going to see the same things over and over again. And maybe that's just how that's life. You know, I don't know, but you got to give something out there. Like I said, in this podcast is a historical document for our community.
Well, what's an additional tragedy to her death itself is that, like, the satanic panic probably contributed to them not finding out who did it. And even things like the McMartin preschool case and things like that, if there was actual abuse, you know, we talked about this before, those terrible motivated, you know, pseudo psychologists getting in there and just messing up all the testimony actually might have covered up something real that happened, because it got so lost in the sauce of just bullshit. And, you know, and that's what's going on today. We know that there is, you know, crazy human trafficking going on gigantic proportions and internationally, but people are looking for boogeymen that don't exist, you know, among politicians and Hollywood people, instead of like the actual stuff going on in their backyard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And it's that shiny object that they're going to go after, you know.
Sure.
Or as Adam said before, I think it was Adam was saying before, it's like the satanic aspect of it is what sold the newspapers. Yeah. It wasn't Kathy's murder.
Right. And that's what perpetuated it. But I mean, I think we got to ask ourselves then, why did everybody believe when the satanic panic was going on? When confronted with stuff that was so absolutely outlandish, like, you know, these kids in McMartin talking about being flown on a plane to some cowboy's castle where they then were, you know, sexually molested. And I mean, like, these types of things where that, you know, Key, I can't remember her last name now, but just essentially the lead on that project as you know, essentially filling the kids' heads. Nonsense, but what was it with the adults that we wanted to believe in Satan so right. bad that we were going to ignore the modern world and just say, like, we think this was all caused by Satan, the right. actual, you know, the actual devil. And now you look at QAnon, and it's more or less similar in the respect that there's still it. Some of it seems to actually, you know, like involve Satan. But, you know, as far as the rest of it goes in terms of just madness, it's right up there, man. I mean, it's like, you know, 9/11 didn't happen. There's a pizzeria where pederast Democrats meet. And, you know, like, I mean, it's crazy. But there's people out there that I'm hoping at least are smart enough to know better, but there's something they want to believe. Part of it mm-hmm. that they just are embracing, just the same way they did with Satan. You know, I mean, as much as Satan is a big part of what we do, and especially the iconography of what we do, I mean, as far as actual belief in Satan, I don't really have much at all. I don't know if Aaron does at all anymore either.
I believe there's evil. Oh, yeah. I believe there, I don't know if it's a bot embodied evil. I believe there's definitely, I believe there's some kind of force out there that can obviously make people do terrible things. Now, whether that's a spirit that can actually make people murder or do terrible things, that's a different story. But, I do believe there's a darkness on things and you, in certain, if you put yourself in a bad headspace, you could get tapped into stuff that maybe you shouldn't be tapped into. So, and I think that has a lot to do with kind of going back to, especially what Serfio was saying at the time, you know, you have this, you know, like industrial decay. You have just this loss of traction of like, this is the life path you're supposed to go on and all the stuff like that. These kids have no direction. We get into a little bit in the podcast, a touch, and maybe we'll talk about it more, but I see, you know, especially in the 80s, women were going to work more. And so you had all of a sudden the family's dynamics were changing. So there was a lot of, you know, people had a lot of like concerns how things were happening. And then we talked about in the graphic novel, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in the podcast in the future, but, you know, we had nuclear destruction. People were scared of that shit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was going to happen, you know, like, so,
we were sure of it at the time. I mean, absolutely.
I mean, you talked about the 13 o'clock. You talked about the movie, it's
Threads.
Blanking on it.
Threads.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like people were definitely scared. So all this, and so you're like, okay, so maybe I have a couple of years at best, you know, before, you know, the world comes to an end, before I have to work in the factory, you know, all this stuff. So you're going to do some crazy stuff. And if you're maybe in a bad home, or if you're in a bad, you know, just, or abusive upbringing, maybe you put yourself in a very dark place mentally. And when you get around these kids, you know, other kids, and you're doing the satanic stuff, you hook onto this and you go full bore into it.
Well, I think when we look at these moral panics and we look at something like Satanic Panic in the 80s or QAnon now, I think you're dealing with a few things. I mean, I think number one, I mean, I think religion is a very powerful thing, and it definitely influences this whole, those two things. And also, I look at it as being a melodramatic explanation to explain a otherwise chaotic world. And you can see that perfectly in that Sons of Sam documentary, because not only is that about, you know, the ideas of Mari Terry, but it's also about him and how Mari Terry began to see all this stuff as a big, gigantic conspiracy, much more than it really was. And I think a lot of it was his own, him trying to explain why the world was just so damn crazy. And why all this crazy shit happened in the 60s. Oh, it must have been the Process Church. It must have been the Manson family. It must have been all these... Somebody was orchestrating this from afar. And he just got caught up in that. And it's like, people want to have this kind of structured, easy to look at, chaotic, non-chaotic plan, structured thing. I remember when COVID was really getting started, I mean, the QAnon people were going crazy, and they were talking about how, you know, this is the storm, this is it, you know. And I honestly was like, hey, I really hope it is, because that's a better alternative than what is actually happening. But they just wanted to explain it in the, like, this is a plan, there's no need to worry. You know, and but it wasn't a plan. There was no plan. It was just chaos.
It is easier when you see when you have a narrative to frame everything, mm-hmm. and it makes it so much. You can put all the blocks in place, and it sort of frames up. That's the problem too with a lot of this. Is, you know, yeah. I even, like, me and Jason talked on the phone, I think it was yesterday, that, you know, I fear that we could start reading into things that just because we have our own narrative. That sure. might be incorrect. So that's right. something we have to, like, kind of like check ourselves and be, you know, kind of cool headed and step back once in a while. Like, does this make sense? Or am I just getting a little too, you know, weird about this? So, I think all that stuff is, like, you know, that Mori Terry, he starts seeing, you know, Satanists in a soup kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was seeing it everywhere. So, I think he had some valid points. I watched that. I was kind of blown away. There's a lot of stuff I did not know about that. So I was blown away, but he obviously just took it way too far. There's a lot going on that obviously was a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. And his stuff really fueled the satanic panic. I mean, it really did. I mean, you know, he was on those same TV talk shows, just, you know, talking about his stuff with the guy that also was talking about how, like, He-Man was a satanic tool, and, you know, so
that's the problem with that kind of stuff, is that, because I remember seeing that part of Sons of Sam and being really impressed with how they edited it, because it just looked, you can see, like, how crestfallen Mori Terry was at that point, because it's like, I'm on here with these idiots talking about He-Man, you know, or just, or, you know, again, you know, like, and, but unfortunately it's just, it's, you end up in some really bad company when you're going that far. And I think, like, we need to, me and him, Aaron, need to, keep this in mind, because again, the dream might be something that could be key to, maybe actually finding something out. Or it might just be a dream that somebody had about Kathy. And before we start going down that Maury Terry, you know, kind of, you know, spiral, you know, it is the kind of thing that we should definitely check ourselves with. Yeah.
I guess it's important to just stay out of Chapel Perilous all you can, right?
Right, exactly. So that's the thing, is that you start, like, everything looks bizarre, but you're also, you know, questioning everything, and I don't know. But I mean, the problem is, we're, like Jason said before, we're talking about a 35-year-old murder. A lot of this information is very old. I honestly wonder, you know, Jason has directly, you know, talked with the authorities on this. I mean, I wonder how competent they are with the material and evidence that they have. I know they probably do have some. Jason, you know, has put Freedom of Information Acts, tried to get information about Kathy's death, and, you know, he's gotten nowhere, stopped on that.
Because they reopened the case, basically, at the beginning of 2020. And
I was going to ask you whether it was an open case still, yeah.
Yeah, and they're able to fob it off due to that, unfortunately. Anyway.
Well, I mean, cold case murders have been solved. You know, I hate to keep bringing it up, but again, you know, like the end of that documentary series, I mean, you know, Arliss Perry, I mean, they found the guy. You know, granted, he shot himself before they could catch him, but they're very sure that that was it. And then, you know, the guy was in his 70s, and I mean, the Golden State Killer, he got caught, you know. So if there's DNA, and especially with all this, like, 23andMe and all this stuff, I mean, that's how East Area Rapist got caught, you know.
Yep. Yep.
So at any time, I mean, if there was something, you know, if there was some material that they found or they collected or a hair or whatever, you know, who knows? I mean, it could happen any time now with the technology.
I would hope.
This person would probably, if they were one of the teenagers, they'd probably be maybe late 40s, early 50s now.
They'd be in their 50s by now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just and to dial back what we were talking before, you know, that's how Antonio Sanchez, the bike path, you know, rapist, was found. But they were watching him. The police suspected him, and they took what, some silverware? No, it was a straw or something like that. They mm-hmm. from a restaurant. They yanked the straw, and they got his DNA off of that, and then it just linked to all these rapes that he did before. So, I mean, it's all you need. Like, literally, just one thing could break open a whole case, and you know, all these terrible crimes are you know, right, are figured out.
And he was a real piece of work. I mean, didn't he kill somebody and then organize, like, the charity event for them or something?
He ran in the charity event, yeah, in the remembrance run for this woman. Wow. So like, the bike path is this Amherst bike path that's outside of Buffalo, and, you know, people bike, they run, you know, rollerblade, all that stuff, walk their dogs. And, you know, he would just hide out in the bushes and just attack these women. It's awful. And obviously he killed this one woman there. And then they start organizing this, like, remembrance run for her, and he would just jump in and be part of it. I mean, just so
number 26 and get on in there. So
I mean, it's just disgusting that this guy, I mean, it, like, I he just, it was so awful that what he did. And then he's
on
just
top,
like,
of that.
And then he's like, let's make it even worse. I'm like, what?
You can hear it in the podcast where we're talking about this, where we're really, me and Aaron just kind of fall apart, you know, as far as, like, all right, you know, this guy's just human garbage. We can't talk about this rationally now.
I edited a lot of that, different parts, but there were parts where it honestly, we kind of make like not vomit noise, but it's just like parts where we're just like, oh, like just like we're just like right. we're just talking about recounting. Like this just gets worse and worse because this guy is so disgusting. And like Jason and I, we didn't even want to talk about him because it had. We don't feel it has a lot to do with Kathy, but she's got tied in with that. And but then we felt like we have to tell that story because people probably don't know who he is. If you're not from the Buffalo right. area, you're just like, okay, it's just another wacko, you know, kind of thing. So
right. And you got to rule him out if he's gonna if people still and there's a lot of people in Western New York that still believe that if they know who Kathy Harold is, that Sanchez is the one who killed her. You know, and it's just, no, that's just, you know, the name got out there and that's kind of what happened.
It's an easy answer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, yeah, we didn't want to talk about it because it's just, the other stuff at least is fascinating. There's nothing fascinating about rape, you know, I mean, sincerely, it just, I don't know. I mean, that's my feeling. I don't know. You may want to.
No, I don't think if as long as you're in right head, your headspace, that's. You shouldn't be fast.
So what are you guys planning on covering next on the show?
Next episodes, we're talking about suicides, right?
Yeah, yeah. This would be the suicides of Kenmore West, primarily in the year between 1985 and 1986. There was at least five during that period we found now. Yeah, we only talk about three in the actual graphic novel, but that's all I could remember. But as it turned out, looking at the articles and stuff, and Aaron made this point earlier, that you get so much more, after the fact, looking back on this stuff and being able to put things together.
Suicide clusters, I think they call it.
You got it. I mean, it would only make sense. I mean, I know there's been a lot more in recent years that are closer together. You know, let's say that take place over the course of like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and that does make news headlines, but in this case it was bare minimum. Other people have talked about more than the five, and it just, you know, we don't have any real we've got, you know, like a pretty solid timeline, but you know, I wouldn't rule out more than that. So, but anyway, that's the focus of the next.
And then we jump into the episode after that. We're jumping into John Justice and telling that story. Because in John Justice, like we've talked a couple times about him already in this podcast, he murdered his family. But what's odd about it, he lived right across the street from this place called Mang Park. Mang Park was where Kathy was supposed to have gone, and then she disappeared. And it literally... if you look down his street, you would see the buildings, the grain elevators of Snakeland. It was right there. There was like, so we're not saying that's connected. He was connected with the Snakeland thing, but it's just this whole overarching, you know, thing happening that we're just
it's interesting.
It's a milieu.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, good absolutely. Word. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a mosaic. Yeah. Right.
Well, this has been very interesting, guys. Where can they find the podcast, and where can they find the graphic novel if they want to?
Well, you can go to the our website, which is returntosnakeland.com. You can look for Return to Snakeland on podcast. We should be up on most platforms now. So,
yeah, absolutely.
And you can email us, especially if you have. If you hear this and you have any information about any of this that we've been talking about, we would love to hear from anybody. You can email us at returnsnakeland@gmail.com.
Okay. Excellent, guys. All right. We're going to do a Patreon episode with you, but we're going to talk about some of the music that you guys talk about in the graphic novel. So,
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Obviously, stay on the line for us, and we will be right back to close out the show and get Spirit Normal. Okay, welcome back, guys. Conspiracy Normal. We're just going to close out the show here. That was a very interesting
Darren O'Brien and Jason Guzman about the Return to Snakeland podcast now.
And it's highly recommended by us.
Yep, highly recommended. If you guys haven't heard it, it is an excellent show. These guys discuss everything that you heard here tonight and also more. So check them out. And it's just anywhere, you know, you can find podcasts. So that's Return to Snakeland.
True crime with paranormal elements.
Yeah, that's yeah. It definitely has some paranormal elements of which we discuss, and I'm sure that they'll get into more of those as well as time goes on. Just real quick, guys, we want to remind everybody that Strange Realities 2021 is coming up in October, October 15th, 16th through 17th. And we have 21 speakers. And I just realized that it's 2021 and we got 21 speakers.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are going to have a really good time. And just to run down the list here, here's who we have. Tim Banal, Nathan Isaac, Brent Rains, Dr. Future is coming back, P.D. Newman, Ren Collier, Steve Stockton, who we had on last week, Aaron Gullius, Amy Petula, Jose Herrera, Chris Ernst, Recluse, otherwise known as Steven Snyder, Kiki Dombrowski, David Metcalf, the great Alan Greenfield, Timothy Renner, Michael Hughes, Joshua Cutchin, Soraya from Where Did the Road Go, Heather Mosher, and Dr. Stephen Finley. So that's a mouthful, but we are very happy to have all these people. Not everyone will be in Nashville. They will be streaming. Some will be streaming from their homes, but we hope to have at least maybe half of those people here on site in Nashville.
And please, in October, if you are fans of those individuals, please encourage them to come so that you can meet them in real life.
That's right. And we are to come to actually be attending in person. It is $70. Online is $30. Consider coming out, guys. It's going to be an interesting time, even though you could just watch it at home, but you will not have the full experience. Some things will not be streamed.
Yeah, you'll really have access to everybody. I don't think anyone in that lineup is very Hollywood, and they'll be very accessible, and it's all about those hallway conversations.
Right, and that's October 15th, 16th through 17th. We're going to talk about that more next week when we have Tim Banal and Aaron Gullius on the show. We kind of do our official kickoff, but strangerealitiesconference.com, you guys can see the new logo for the 2021 is up there, and also there on the front page right under the banner there is a link that you can go and you can buy tickets, so check those out as soon as possible. Also, Patreon we have available if you guys want to support the show. There's some perks that you have, and Surfiel could tell you about that.
Well, at patreon.com/conspiranormal, you can catch a new Patreon episode every week, which we just did one with the Return to Snakeland guys, talking about the soundtrack to Return to Snakeland, and we'll have a link up for that for everybody as well. But they really go into depth about a lot of the music and kind of subcultural landscape that was going on at the time that surrounded everything that happened there. And at the next level, a $10 level, every month we've been having these really cool meetings of our Mystic crew, and we have presentations at them. So if you're like a fan of Strange Realities, you like getting some exclusive cutting-edge research of different friends of the show and presenters, you can get that for only $10 a month, get to hang out and talk with everybody, get access to some of your favorite conspiranormal guests. And at the $20 level, the top of the holy mountain is the Ancient Circle of Strange Realities, and you will be giving all the secrets, the final secrets of the Illuminati, and access to the secret chiefs and a VIP experience at the Strange Realities 2020, both in person and virtually. 2021. And so patreon.com/conspiranormal.
All right, absolutely. Okay, guys, we're gonna sign out, but join us next time. We're gonna have Tim Banal and Aaron Gullius. We're just gonna have a good time. Talk to you later on
Conspiranormal.
would like to help the show, please consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at